All right, I've switched the configuration around because I'm a little more agile. This way I can look at you better than being stuck off in the corner. Let's continue our exploration of the problem of race in America today. So the last lecture took us through the historical trajectory of different forms of racism. It's a pretty dismal history. It's a history of deeply troubling forms of social relations in which people are humiliated, degraded, harmed, and suffer. If it were the case that this was somehow just an unalterable fact of the human condition, that human beings are the sorts of creatures that like to create invidious distinctions between insiders and outsiders, and then impose harms on those who are excluded. If this was an intrinsic part of our nature, then this dismal history could be used as evidence that there's really not much that can be done. But of course, that's not what I believe. I hope it's not what most of you believe as well. It may be true that we are hardwired to make distinctions. I think we are classificatory creatures. That's what human minds do. They make distinctions. And it is true that in unequal societies where there are conflicts over resources, over status, over all sorts of things that people care about, those classification systems which we carry around in our understanding of the world often get deployed around other kinds of social divisions. Divisions where real resources are at stake, for example. So we certainly are, as human beings, as part of our nature, the kinds of creatures that can socially create these sorts of harms, these sorts of structures. I don't think, however, that the conclusion from that is that there's not a whole lot we can do about it. There is a lot we can do about it, and indeed, in addition to this historical saga of different forms of racial domination and the harms it has created, there is also an historical saga of struggles against racism, of struggles to transform these forms of divisions in ways that would dismantle the harshness of these types of oppressions, with the ultimate ideal, the kind of vision for an emancipatory future where racial domination, exclusion, and oppression would simply disappear. It would wither away. In my lifetime, you know, I'm 70 years old. I turned 70 a few weeks ago. It's very weird for me to say that. I think this may be the first time I've ever said in public that number associated with my name, and it's very strange for me. I mean, I don't know how strange it is for you, but it's certainly a strange realization. I've been teaching here for 40 years. In my lifetime, I have both witnessed and participated in efforts at that transformation. When I was a teenager, I hitchhiked to Washington, D.C. in 1963 for the famous March on Washington with Martin Luther King. It was an extraordinary experience. What was extraordinary in part is, of course, the size and the interracial composition of that March on Washington, and to hear the I Have a Dream speech. As a kid, I was in the audience, in the crowd, listening to that speech. What we didn't realize at the time was that this was some historical high point of the civil rights movement. Things began to unravel pretty quickly after that. We thought at the time that this was demonstrating the power and solidarity and hope of the future, and that we were just on the upsurge, that things were only going to get better from that point on. The achievements of the civil rights movement were consolidated. The segregationist laws were destroyed. in the early to mid-1960s. Various new laws around voting rights were enacted, around fair housing, all sorts of changes in the way people were allowed legally to conduct their lives. It was no longer legal after the mid-1960s, for example, for banks to draw lines on city maps and say, African Americans can't get mortgages outside of these zones. That used to be legal. Shortly after the Civil Rights March on Washington and the accompanying legislation, the last vestige of laws prohibiting interracial marriage disappeared. There's an interesting historical movie about that, about the loving family, wonderful accident of history that was their last name, an interracial couple in Virginia that was arrested because you weren't allowed to marry across racial lines. That's the sort of thing which, to a contemporary 21st century ear, just sounds bizarre, that you would have a law saying that marrying across a racial line was illegal. Just, it's astounding that that was illegal. It was, and it no longer is. So there were these historical achievements in the 1960s. The dismantling of the machinery of racial segregation was a huge achievement. And along with that came the erosion, rather than an abrupt change, in some of the cultural supports, the symbolic meaning systems in support of racism. And the progress from this is real. In 1963, we thought we were just at the beginning of this great progress, and we would just continue to the end. Of course, things didn't work out that way, and the progress in many respects stagnated in the 1970s, and in certain crucial ways deteriorated beginning in the late 70s and beyond. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, I think it's important to both recognize and, in a sense, celebrate the historical achievements that have occurred over the last, since the civil rights era of the 60s, including the civil rights era itself. African-American ads in television, African-Americans appearing in ads and on television. When I was growing up, there were no African-American characters on standard television shows, except in very caricatured roles. There was nothing like the breakthrough Bill Cosby show of the 1980s, and certainly no shows where you'd see a black mayor, black police officers buddied with white police officers, all the sorts of standard fare we now expect to see on television. Interracial marriage has become acceptable. In parts of the country, still not still frowned upon by parts of the population, but broadly speaking, in American society, it's no longer shocking to see an interracial couple. There's the emergence of a vibrant black middle class, and positive images of African Americans are common, particularly in certain specific areas like sports and entertainment, but not restricted to that. We have prominent black politicians that are admired on both the left and the right. Ben Carson is admired by people on the right of the American political spectrum, just as Barack Obama is on the left. We had Morgan Freeman playing the role of God in the movie Bruce Almighty. Now that's really quite astounding. It's just unthinkable that 50 years earlier, even in a silly comedy like Bruce Almighty, you would have a black actor playing the role of God. It just wouldn't have been done. It wouldn't have been seen as a kind of funny, quirky thing to do, as a sort of tease. Now, of course, that was its point. Its point was to disrupt expectations. If you're going to have a God figure, if they had a black woman playing the role, it would have been even more disruptive, of course. But It was disruptive, but disruptive in a way that people didn't find in general offensive. And I think even people who were sincerely religious didn't find the movie offensive. They may or may not have liked it, but they didn't find the idea of portraying God with a black actor as somehow a violation of some fundamental cultural standards. Well, those are all tremendous achievements. Let's look at some data about achievements. I know I sometimes inundate you with data, so remember, these slides will be available, so you can look at them at your leisure. I will go through them, but I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time explaining what they mean. This is a, and most of these slides replicate things or in the book, but some of them are additional to what's in the book. So this is a public opinion on approval, disapproval of interracial marriages in the United States from 1950 to 2007, so roughly over a half century period. There are really very few social attitudes in which you'd see a drop from over 90% to under 20% on any attitude over a half century. That's a huge change in public opinion. In 1958, over 90% of people in the United States said they disapproved of interracial marriages. Over 90% said they disapproved, and only about 4% said they approved. You know, 4% said they didn't know, they didn't have an opinion on the matter. Today it's under 20%. That's really an astounding change in public opinion. And it's a change that's matched by a steady increase in the actual phenomenon of interracial marriages. Among newly married couples in 2010, you know, roughly 1 in 8 were interracial. 1 in 7 were interracial. This is the distribution. Almost 20% of newlyweds in which there was a black person in the marriage was part of an interracial marriage. So that's a real change. And if this change persists over time, it will continue to normalize that phenomenon. And inevitably, I think, the normalization of interracial marriage is part of the erosion of the cultural salience of the classification system in which we can say it's an interracial marriage. This graph shows over the last 50 years or so the completion rates of different levels of education. And again, there's just no question that this represents improvement. You know, in 1957, the ratio of the completion of 4 years of college by 25 to 29-year-olds. So the reason you look at it at that age is that that shows the contemporary completion rates. If you take the population as a whole, of course, you'll have older people from an earlier generation where going to college was much less common. If you just look at the completion rate for people 25 to 29, since relatively few people complete a four-year undergraduate degree older than 29. Some people do, of course. Some people come back when they're older, but that's a very small percentage. That sort of tells you what the current situation is. Well, you can see in 1957, about 10% of whites in that age group had completed a four-year college degree, but only a couple of percent of blacks had. The rate was 4 or 5 times higher for whites than blacks. Now the gap is still significant, but the disproportion is much less today. And for high school completion for people 25 years or older, for high school completion, basically you're getting very close to parity. The educational gaps remain, but they're smaller than they were in the period when legal segregation existed before the civil rights movement was successful. If we look at occupational distributions as well, we find that there remains a black-white differential in high-status occupations, but the differential is much smaller than it was 50 or 60 years ago. So there has been progress, but there has also been continuing realities of significant economic disadvantage. These are mapped out in some detail in the chapter in the book. I'll just run through some of the issues that are discussed there. First, this graph shows the median black family income as a percentage of the white median family income. Now, in the late 40s and 50s, it hovered around 50%. That is, the median, remember, if you need reminding, means the family that's right in the middle of the distribution, smack in the middle of the distribution. It's not the same as average. Median is the household that's in the distribution. Is something beeping? What's beeping? Oh, it says my battery is about to expire. Let's see if... Well, it hasn't expired yet, but I suppose it's going to annoy me, if not you, to have it beeping at me throughout the... All right. Can I multitask? Can I talk about median family incomes while I change the batteries? No. And can I even change the batteries? Yes. Okay. Maybe not. Yes. Okay. Is that working? It is, and it's not beeping. Good. So in the 1950s, that hovered around 50%. Since then, it's gone up and down, but hovering around 60%. So there was some initial improvement, but it's still the case that the median household among African Americans only has an income about 60% that of white families. And if we look at wealth, that is the assets that you own, the value of your home, the value of any investments, minus the debts that you hold, that hasn't changed much at all in the last 40 or 50 years. We don't have this data going back to the pre-civil rights era. It's probably higher than it was in the 1950s. That is, the ratio is a little bit better, but it's still the case that the ratio of, this is average wealth, not median wealth, of white to of black to white families is only about 20%. This is poverty rates for children. I emphasize for children because although I think it's a significant, it's a serious problem of poverty among adults, I think there is no controversy whatsoever that poverty is a problem for children. You know, no matter how much of a hard-nosed survival of the fittest, you know, tough love person you are, no matter what your political views are about how you have to create personal responsibility by having people take responsibility for their own condition in life, it's pretty hard to make that claim about children. So the most you can say is that if the parents are poor and thus the children are poor, that's just an unfortunate side effect because we shouldn't help poor parents because they should take responsibility for their own lives. That's a standard kind of conservative view about poverty for adults. And maybe you could justify poverty for children just as an unfortunate byproduct of that. But it still is an unfortunate byproduct. Nobody says children are responsible for their own poverty. And thus, poverty rates among children are a salient moral issue, I think, really for virtually everybody, when you really think about it. And it's the justification for all sorts of welfare programs that are directed towards children. Although we have cut those back dramatically in the United States, even before the current situation. Well, as you can see, poverty rates among black children are much higher than among white children. And the racial gap really has not substantially closed. This is specific Wisconsin data. This is old data now. This is from 2004. the pattern will not have changed, although, of course, the numbers may have changed somewhat. 2017 is probably a little bit worse in general than it was in 2004. So this looks at the distribution within racial categories of poverty, near poverty, that's, I believe, people living between the poverty line and twice the poverty line, and non-poverty. And you can see that for whites living in Wisconsin in the early 2000s, the non-poverty rate was 73%. 73% of Wisconsin residents who were white were non-poor, and only 7% were poor, whereas for African Americans, 33% were poor, and only 42% were non-poor, that is living at least twice the poverty rate. This is the share of Wisconsin workers earning poverty wages. So this is different from the poverty rate. This is saying what proportion of people who are working at jobs that pay wages that are poverty rate wages in 1979 and 2003. Again, this is dated, out-of-date figures. I don't believe the patterns have changed, but I wasn't able to update the data. I think I may have said this. I really planned to update all of these graphs, but then I got hit by the car in November, and it sort of disrupted my updating strategies. I'm definitely going to put the effort into doing it before the next time I teach the class. So I'm just repeating that these are patterns that are probably familiar to many of you. It's important to really get them in your head and to think about the implications. The situation for white women has improved considerably. For white men, it's pretty much the same as it was between 1979 and 2003. Roughly similar levels of people working for poverty wages. For black women, the situation hasn't changed, but is much higher than for white women today. But for black men, there's been a significant deterioration. It's not just that things haven't improved, things have gotten worse. A much higher proportion of black men who are working, so we're not talking about unemployed and not talking about people who have been marginalized from the labor market. These are working people. A much higher percentage in the year 2003 are working for poverty wages than was the case in 1979. Okay, another dimension of the current situation. The continuing realities of active discrimination. So remember, discrimination refers to various ways in which people are treated differently to the disadvantage of those who are discriminated, but in ways that are not inscribed in law. So segregation in the South, when it was legal, was not, shouldn't be described just as discrimination. That was legal oppression. It wasn't just discrimination. I'm using the term discrimination, and this is the sort of standard way of using it, to describe the mundane practices of people as they interact that puts some people at a disadvantage compared to others. One class category of active discrimination can be called petty harassment. This periodically gets into the news because people do little experiments to check, for example, how long does it take for a black man in Manhattan to get a taxi compared to a white man dressed in a similar manner? So we're controlling for the costume that you're wearing. You get a young black man dressed respectably, in quotes, in a suit and tie, and a white man dressed in a suit and tie. How long, on average, does it take to get a taxi? It takes black men, in particular, longer than white men to get taxis. Surveillance in stores. This is a common experience that when African Americans go into a clothing store and start, you know, going through the hangers and pulling things off shelves to look at them, store personnel shadow them. And there's research that's been done to observe the behavior of store personnel when white people who are similarly dressed, so it's not that some disreputable looking, you know, street person, as it were, walks into a fancy store, identically dressed white and black shoppers, and just observe what the store clerks do. How much do they track them just by looking at them? And there is absolutely no question that African-American shoppers have higher levels of surveillance than white shoppers. That's petty harassment. But there are other aspects of discrimination that have bigger consequences for the lives of people than just petty harassment. I wouldn't minimize the salience, however, of petty harassment. You shouldn't think, well, by virtue of it being called petty harassment, it doesn't really matter. It does have a cumulative effect on one's sense of self in a world in which you're being watched and mistrusted by people you encounter casually, compared to a world in which that experience is absent. But let's look at some cases which are more serious. These are results of what's called a housing audit. A housing audit. This is a general idea in social science research, the use of the term audit, or as you can think of it as a social audit that takes different forms. Employment and housing are the two most common versions of this. The way this kind of research is done, you get a black couple and a white couple to go into a real estate agent and ask for and tell them what their income is and the kind of neighborhood they want to live in and what sort of house they want. And they say exactly the same thing. They have exactly the same preferences. And then the question is, for both renting and for purchase, what is the array of houses they are shown? How do the real estate agents respond to the same stimulus, the same information, but offered differently by African-American or white couples? Well, this shows the adverse treatment against blacks and Hispanics in 1989 and 2000 in a housing audit study in which you have couples who are acting as testers seeking rentals and home purchases. These figures are the percentage of people who experienced what are called an adverse treatment. That is, they're not shown or given options that are as generous and desirable as the ones shown to the white population. It's always tested against the kind of white standard. There has been improvement. for sales, that is, the discriminatory behavior towards sales has gone down, but it's still the case that somewhere between 15 and 20% of Black and Hispanic couples seeking home purchases are shown less desirable properties than their white counterparts. The example of employment is the more typical one that housing, that audit studies are done. The way these studies are, there's a variety of ways an employment audit can be done. One common way, which you may have seen discussed in the news from time to time, is sending in resumes to an employer who's, you know, responding to an ad, by sending in resumes in which the only difference in the resume is the name. And since there is a fairly significant difference between the typical names of whites and blacks in the United States, you can signal to an employer your race by having the name on the resume. And then the question is, how are these resumes evaluated? Another kind of employment audit actually has people going to an employer for to seek interviews, filling out an application at the employer's location and submitting them. And again, having black and white testers do this. These audits are typically thought of as tapping into what's called statistical discrimination. So here's another big concept. All right, so in your dictionary part of your notes where you're saying, aha, this is an idea, a big concept, I need to really figure it out, I need to understand it, not just be able to, in a rote kind of way, repeat the definition. Let me explain what statistical discrimination is. Statistical discrimination is a situation in which an employer makes a hiring decision about an individual on the basis of beliefs about the average characteristics of a person in a social category, rather than the characteristics of that particular person. Now, why would you do this? You do it because it's less costly, not because you dislike people in that category. So statistical discrimination is different from just plain ordinary discrimination. So think of it this way. You're an employer, and a young African-American man in his early 20s applies for a job. Now, one reason you might discriminate against that person, that is, make it harder for that person to get a job, make it less likely to hire that person. One is that you just don't like to be around black people. Right, that's just straightforward discrimination. You yourself dislike black people, and therefore you'll be prejudiced in favor of hiring whites. That's one way that discrimination happens. That's the simplest way, and I think that's the way most people think about how this game is played, how in a society you end up with discrimination. It has to do with individual likes and dislikes. That's not statistical discrimination. Statistical discrimination works as follows. Suppose that you believe that on average, a young black man will be less reliable as an employee than a young white man with the same formal qualifications. They have the same high school degree, they've had the same work experience, everything's the same, except you believe that on average, black men in that category will be less trustworthy or less reliable or less responsible, whatever the characteristic in question is, than white people with the same descriptions otherwise. And since it's difficult to get good information about the particular person within that distribution, the employer relies on presumed group traits to make the choice. So here's the issue. It's costly to bore down to really get information about how reliable is Joe and how reliable is Jamal, you know, if you want to use the stereotypical kind of name signals. It's hard to get that information. Somebody shows up and they fill out the application. How do you know how reliable they are? Well, if you have beliefs about the average reliability of the category in which that person falls, you can then say, well, I'm just going to go with my hunch based on the average of the groups. Now, sometimes those beliefs about groups are completely screwy, but other times the beliefs about the groups, that is, what is it like on average, may actually reflect a real difference between the groups. Right? So it may be the case that for various reasons, the absentee rate of young black men or women from certain kinds of employment will be higher than for the similarly aged and qualified young whites. This could be, for example, because they rely more heavily on public transportation. They don't have cars because they don't have the same amount of family assets to buy a car. And or because they are, for example, a single parent who sometimes has emergencies with children, which causes absenteeism from work. So it could be the case that there is actually a group difference, and nevertheless, a given individual within that group could be on the very reliable, low absenteeism end of the spectrum. And it's just costly to get information about individual differences and cheaper to get information about group differences. And it's especially cheap to get information about your beliefs about group differences, not actual data about the groups, just your beliefs about group differences. That's called statistical discrimination. And that leads to a discriminatory act on the part of employers. Here's results of a study done by a graduate student whose dissertation I supervised. She's now a professor at Harvard. I mean, that's just to show that it's not just that I think she was terrific. Other people thought she was terrific, too. Her name was Diva Pager. And what she did is she hired of testers in Milwaukee. I think they were undergraduates at Marquette. So she hired two young black men and two young white men. Again, same resumes, same basic background. But they had the following profile. They were high school graduates. They had a couple of years of work experience in low skilled jobs. They were applying for entry-level positions in a low skilled job. They differed in the following way. One of the two white applicants had a year and a half prison record for a nonviolent drug offense, and one didn't. And one of the young black men had the same year and a half prison sentence for a nonviolent drug offense, and the other one didn't. So we have four categories of people. Whites with no prison records, whites with prison records, blacks without a prison record, and blacks with a prison record. And in other respects, their resumes were the same. Same work experience, high school degree, they dressed nicely when they went for to drop off their job applicants. And the test of this audit was, do you get a call back for the job? It wasn't whether or not you got the job, but did you get a call back for an interview? And it's typically for this kind of job, a low-skill, entry-level job, the call back is very close to actually being offered the job. That is, the reason for an interview for this kind of low-skill job is just for the personnel manager at the firm to meet the person and to kind of verify that the person actually seems like the person that they saw on paper. So you can pretty much think of this as job offers, but technically it was a callback. Well, the results are pretty striking. 40% of the whites with no prison record got callbacks. 20% of the whites with a prison record. 17% of blacks without a prison record. And only about 3.5% of blacks with a prison record. Basically, the whites with a prison record and the blacks without a prison record should be viewed as the same. It's about 20%. The 3% difference in those callbacks, to use the kind of technical language, that wasn't statistically significant. That difference could have just happened randomly. So what this says is that being black puts you at about the same disadvantage as having a prison record. That's how much it costs you. You know, you can think of this. What's the cost of being a young black male? It's about the same as a white having a 1.5-year prison record for a nonviolent drug offense. That is, employers will see these as roughly equivalent risks in hiring. Again, I think the implication of this is probably statistical discrimination. That is, we have no reason to believe that it's because of particular dislikes of the types of persons, but of a belief about what people in that category are likely to be like. Discrimination, active discrimination, and I say active because it's acting in the world to actually create ongoing disadvantage, continues even after legal discrimination has been abolished. Okay, a different issue. Spending per pupil on kids going to different kinds of school districts. Now, it's pretty hard to get data to actually show directly racial discrimination in public allocation of resources to schooling, because the allocations are not formally done on the basis of race. That is, there isn't in a school board decision about allocating resources a category, a black school and a white school, black predominant, white predominant, aha, let's put less resources in one than the other. That's not how it works. But there still is discriminatory effects if you look at the spending per pupil in rich suburbs and cities, since in each of these cases, Chicago's and New York, city schools are predominantly minority, and suburban schools are, particularly the wealthy suburban schools, are predominantly white. And what this graph shows is continuing significant differentials in the per pupil spending. Even in the relatively recent past, this is 2010-11 school years. Now we get to a really big deal part of the problem. When I said that there have been major achievements since the civil rights era, and on many indicators things have continued to improve if at a slower rate, such as schooling, for example, there is one dimension of social life in which the differential treatment of blacks and whites has gotten worse since the civil rights era, since the 1960s, and that concerns incarceration. These figures, I think, again, may be familiar to many of you. The United States, in general, has by far the highest rates of imprisonment of any country in the world. I mean, we have the highest proportion of our population locked up of any country, not just other rich countries, of any country in the world. We have a higher proportion of our population locked up than in various dictatorships, which are repressive, and their prison conditions may be much worse. I'm not saying that the actual conditions of life in prisons are worse here than in the worst places in the world, but the higher proportion of our citizens are locked up than in other countries. This first graph presents the overall US incarceration rates from the 1920s until the present. Just so you know, the lingo, the difference between a prison and a jail is that prisons are for convicted felons, and jails are local institutions to house people who are either convicted for less than a year, typically, or are awaiting trial. So prisons are for the longer term incarceration. Jails are typically for shorter terms. There are some exceptions. There are some jails that basically function more like prisons, but they're a different jurisdiction. Prisons are run by states, jails are run by cities and counties. So the overall incarceration rate in the United States is vastly higher than in other countries. That was even true before the big run-up. That was true in the 1970s. That is, the rate at that time, which was between 100 and 200 prisoners per 100,000 population, that rate even then was the highest of any country in the world. But since then, it's gotten vastly higher. Well, what's going on here? Well, let's look at this by race. This is the incarceration rates by race for blacks, whites, and Latinos, and also for broken down separately for males and young males. So the first thing to note is that there is a big racial gradient. It's much more likely to be incarcerated if you're black than white, much more likely if you're a black male, and vastly more likely if you're a young black male. Here is a graph of the differential arrest rates for drug offenses for blacks and whites. So in the 1960s and 70s, it was higher for blacks than whites. Blacks got arrested for drug offenses more than whites. But the gap wasn't all that big. Since the 1970s, the drug arrest rate for whites has increased only modestly, but it has increased dramatically for blacks. This is reflected in this graph, which shows the disparity rate, the black to white disparity rate in prison sentences by offense group. This was arrest rates. This is prison sentences. So in the early 1980s, the black to white ratio, disparity ratio in prison sentences for drug offenses was about 6-1, and it shot up during the heyday of the war on drugs to 18-1, and has never fallen down, declined to the levels of disproportion, which were still disproportionate for blacks, that occurred before the war on drugs. And this is a very different picture from the disparity rates for other crimes. That is, for robberies, violent crimes, theft, and miscellaneous other, the disparity rate between blacks and whites hasn't changed much, and if anything, over this period had a tendency to decline, whereas the disparity rates for drug offenses increased enormously. This graph shows the disparity between blacks and whites, the black as percentage category of the population, of drug users, drug offense arrests, convictions, and imprisonments. So one reason you might think there was a higher rate of imprisonment for black drug offenders than white drug offenders is that there's a much higher rate of drug use among blacks than whites, but that just isn't true. There isn't a higher rate of drug use among blacks than whites. There's just a higher arrest rate and higher conviction rate and higher imprisonment rate. The impression that the war on drugs was really a war on African Americans who use drugs was really a racially motivated, not just anti-drug campaign. If it was an anti-drug campaign, it should have hit white drug users as much as black drug users. It didn't. The idea that there's a racial component to this incarceration increase, at least a racial component, if not it being driven by racial concerns, racial motives, which is harder to show, of course, that it's actually to be explained by race primarily, as opposed to race as one of the contributing factors. It's certainly a racialized process. Well, the rest of, I keep piling on the data on here. This is the imbalance in arrests for marijuana possession. So marijuana is, of course, the least damaging of the various illegal drugs. Many states in the United States now have decriminalized marijuana use, and in some states have actually made the sale of marijuana legal, in Colorado, for example. So whatever your views are as to whether it's a good or bad thing to make marijuana use legal or illegal, virtually nobody thinks it's as damaging a drug as meth or even heroin. So disparities in the racial arrests for drugs when for marijuana seems especially egregious, since that's not such a damaging drug. Well, this shows for various cities in California the disparities in the arrest rates for blacks and whites for the use of marijuana. And again, the white use of marijuana, actual patterns of racial use of marijuana, it's higher for whites. A higher percentage of whites have both ever used marijuana in the last year or in the last month than blacks and Latinos. Here's a graph for New York City. I mean, this really shows what's going on, that this is a public policy issue. Until 1993, so what this shows is the number of marijuana arrests in New York City. Until the Giuliani campaign, mayorship in the 1990s, marijuana arrests were small in number in New York City, and they just go through the roof, starting in the 1990s. This is a political choice. We are going to get tough on drugs, and we're going to get tough on drugs in part by arresting people for very minor drug use. Another graph, this is the number of blacks, Latinos, and whites arrested for possession in New York in those two decades. So here's the general pattern of arrests. Let's see who actually gets arrested. So in the earlier period with little arrests, it's still disproportionately black, but there aren't that many arrests. When the big run-up occurs, you can see what happens. The black population is five, 53% of pot arrests, but only 26% of the New York City population. Latinos are 33% of pot arrests, but 27% of the population. Whites are 12% of pot arrests, but 35% of the New York City population. But remember, whites still smoke marijuana more than blacks. And this is arrests for possession. This is just having marijuana on you when you're arrested. Okay, prospects for the future. So what do we have up to this point? We have a historical past that is deeply troubling. We have what I would consider a break in that historical past that culminates in the civil rights movements of the 1960s that really does change the nature of the game. The state is no longer backing the explicit oppression and exclusion and domination of African Americans in particular. But the civil rights legislation is more general than just African Americans. It bars, it makes it illegal to have official segregation and official forms of discrimination. And in the decades since then, there has been a change. The cultural changes are particularly striking. The Morgan Freeman playing God. But the material changes are also real, if not as big as one would like. In education, most clearly. In income and wealth, less clearly. There were initial gains, but those gains did not continue. And in other respects, discrimination and disadvantage remains deeply troubling, most troubling around the policing and imprisonment problem. Well, what about prospects for the future? There are three general conclusions. Considerable progress, I've said already. Continuing harmful discrimination. Racialized poverty remains an acute problem. What should be done? How do we fix it? What do we do? Well, one possibility is do nothing, you know, if you, again, believe in a kind of fatalistic view about human possibilities. If you believe that once you've gotten rid of official legal segregation, then we are now in a post-racial era, then maybe you would support the view that we have no collective responsibility to do anything. Well, as you know, I disagree with that conclusion. I think we have a responsibility to do something, partially because of the historical legacies of what was unambiguously structures of oppression in the historic past, but that's not quite enough to motivate major action today. I think the ongoing reality of racial division, oppression, marginalization, and discrimination, that ongoing reality is really what creates the moral imperative to do something. Well, what should be done? Well, one thing is related to the general problems of poverty and inequality. Even aside from having a set of programs that are specifically designed to deal with the racialized dimensions of poverty or the racialized dimensions of employment discrimination, even if we put aside any special programs directed specifically at the racialized dimensions of those issues, if we had serious programs opposed to poverty, really serious anti-poverty programs, and job creation programs to create an abundance of well-paying living wage jobs for people with relatively low skills. So if we really did those things that I laid out in the solutions to poverty discussion, that would have, as a kind of knock-on effect, significant impact on the racialized character of poverty. I mean, in a kind of simple, obvious, this is almost an arithmetic point. If you eliminate poverty, you eliminate black poverty. So one thing to think about is to really take seriously the anti-poverty problem, to think about the policies that would make significant inroads in that, and that in and of itself would have an impact on the poverty of racially disadvantaged and oppressed groups as well. Indeed, eliminating black poverty by as a side effect of eliminating poverty in general, if we could do that, you know, if I could snap my fingers. I suppose if I could snap my fingers and do just one thing around race, if I, you know, had that magical power, I'm Morgan Freeman in the movie. I can snap my fingers and change the world. I probably would snap my fingers and just eliminate poverty, because the consequences of that for race would be profound, since it's this hookup between race and inequality that helps to reproduce racism itself. It contributes to the reproduction of racism because of the way it's linked to, connected to other forms of domination and inequality. And if I could just eliminate poverty magically, that would also have a substantial impact on the subsequent course of racial division. So that's the first thing. Secondly, we need change in the criminal justice system from repression to treatment, training, and reintegration. And around drug offenses, we just need a completely rethought way of dealing with this. We are the most repressive country of the liberal democracies around the issues of drugs. This is even apart from the thorny questions of which drugs should be legalized, which shouldn't, and how you should deal with it. To have this massively repressive apparatus around drugs in particular, but as a general stance towards punishing people for deviance, for breaking laws, the punitive aspect, which I suppose is rooted in our Puritan cultural heritage, I think that needs dramatic change. And of course, within that kind of change, the elimination of all the procedures and strategies which create distinctive racial differentials. One of the notorious examples that's often discussed is the huge difference in the sentencing requirements for crack cocaine compared to powder cocaine. Powder cocaine is what yuppies on Wall Street used. Crack cocaine is what poor people used. So we had drastically higher penalties for crack cocaine than powder cocaine, and there's no evidence that it is dramatically worse for you, that it's a more pernicious drug. It's just a different form of the same drug. So these are two things that should be done, but what about discrimination itself? What about all these subtle forms of discrimination? You know, the employment audit that shows that employers just, in fact, really do discriminate. And that particular one that I showed from my student, Diva Pager, that's one of many studies. And they all show the same thing. And they show them throughout the United States. It's not that she did it in Milwaukee. It's not that it's dramatically worse than in Milwaukee than in other places. It's on this particular thing, on the employment audit, racism in employment, discrimination. You see that in New York City as well, supposedly enlightened places, as well as traditionally, places we think of as traditionally unenlightened around race. So what can you do about discrimination? Well, one view is that if you feel discriminated, you should go to court and sue the person that discriminated. Discrimination isn't legal. Employers are not legally, it's against the law to deny somebody a job because they're black. So one argument is, well, that's what courts are for. Well, as you can imagine, that's a pretty implausible strategy. First of all, most people can't gather any evidence that they personally have been discriminated. To do that, you'd have to know the full range of people that were applied for a job, what all of their qualifications were, and over time, how does the employer make those choices. And how is a 25-year-old applicant for a low-skilled job possibly going to be able to challenge an employer? Besides which, the resources it takes to bring a case to court are huge, and employers have an advantage in their ability to stall in court, to hire lawyers, to do all the things. So the idea that you can deal with discrimination, wage discrimination for women, promotion discrimination around gender, that you can deal with this by just individuals suing the discriminator is really simply a way of saying there's nothing you can do about it. This cannot be effectively fought by individual suits. Well, what's the alternative? The alternative goes under this broad name of affirmative action. Now, talk about a charged, controversial policy. Affirmative action is a very controversial way of dealing with discrimination. Let's just look at it, though. First, the definition. Affirmative action is any policy that takes into account membership in some historically discriminated group, race and gender being the two most prominent examples, to increase the likelihood of a person from that group getting a job or being admitted to a university. This has been a very controversial, hotly debated issue within universities. There's an irony here because if you take elite universities like Harvard, for example, they have and continue to have a form of affirmative action for children of rich alumni. You know, they call this legacy admissions. So people who apply to elite universities who come from families that have a long tradition of having children go to that university, the child of a Harvard alumni, particularly a child of a rich Harvard alumni that has given donations to the university, they get an explicit advantage. It's not an informal policy, it's an official policy. You know, it's part of the admission structure. You get an advantage. Now, the argument for it is very straightforward and even reasonable. There's, you know, it's reasonable from the point of view of the finances of the university. Somebody's parents give a few $1 million of donations. You're likely to end up a very wealthy person. If we admit you, we're going to have a stream of donations in the future. Well, that's good for the health of the financial endowment of a university. So it's not crazy that Harvard has affirmative action for rich children of wealthy alumni. But it makes the idea that they shouldn't have affirmative action for minorities seem kind of a kind of precious distinction. You shouldn't have affirmative action for historically disadvantaged groups, but only for advantaged groups. That seems a little ass backwards in terms of any moral criteria. So that's affirmative action, is just anything. Now, there's various ways of doing it. There's a variety of policies. Affirmative action can be put into place in particular ways. You can have specific quotas or looser targets. You can have affirmative action as a tie-breaking rule. So you have an admissions procedure that says we define a group of admittable students. That's everybody who's above a certain bar. So you have some cutoff point. If you're below that, you can't be admitted. If you're above that, you are admittable. That is, you satisfied the criterion of being able to do well in this university. And then but there's too many of those people. We can't admit them all. You could do it randomly at that point, and that's kind of what happens. The rank ordering of students among the admittable category, it's pretty random. Or at that point, you can say, a tie-breaking rule to admit disadvantaged children from disadvantaged backgrounds. You can engage in intensive recruitment campaigns. And this many universities, including Wisconsin, have done. They decide to devote a significant part of university resources to try to go to high schools where there are high concentrations of minority students and try to convince students to apply. So that you increase the applicant pool and therefore increase the probability of admitting. Now that still counts as affirmative action. Might not seem like affirmative action. It still does, because it does increase the likelihood of a particular person from a group getting admitted, and using university resources to increase that likelihood. Or you can have a system where you have points added to recruitment scores. I think there's a good justifications for that version. If we think that growing up in a disadvantaged world means that your scores on things like the SAT have been artificially reduced. I gave the example of children who take Kaplan courses or Princeton courses to improve their SAT scores because their parents can afford it, and because they are in the cultural milieu where that's the expected thing to do, they should get some negative points on their admissions. You should have a question: did you take an SAT enhancement course? And if yes, you get some minus points because you shouldn't be given as much credit for whatever your score is. Well, I think the effects of ongoing discrimination and disadvantage based on race means that it's harder to achieve the same level of formal criteria, and so points are perfectly legitimate to add points to an admissions roster to compensate for the disadvantages that you've experienced. Some of those disadvantages come from poverty in class. Some of them come from the lack of educational resources in the schools you go to. But some of those disadvantages do directly come from ongoing racism in the world in which we live, as indicated by the various indicators of continuing discrimination that we've reviewed and which are discussed in more detail in the book. Well, there are important objections to affirmative action. People say affirmative action is a form of reverse discrimination. It unfairly puts whites at a competitive disadvantage. That's an argument that I don't think can be dismissed out of hand. It's a legitimate argument. If you are denied admission to a university program and somebody with slightly lower scores who's from a racial minority is admitted, there are good reasons for you to feel, well, that's not fair. I didn't discriminate against anybody. I haven't myself imposed disadvantages on others. How can it be fair that somebody with a lower score than I did got admitted over me just because of a particular racial characteristic? And that does feel like the experience of that is discriminatory. Now, if we lived in a world in which there wasn't the background condition of ongoing discrimination that continually reproduces the disadvantages of minorities in their general navigation of the difficulties of life, if there wasn't that background condition of ongoing discrimination, then that argument about reverse discrimination, I think, would have not just existential weight. It has weight in the lives of people, for sure. But it would be a legitimate objection to having affirmative action. And there could be a time, I mean, hopefully there will be a time in the future, where that argument would be a killer argument, because it would, one could say, we don't need these policies to neutralize existing discrimination any longer, because existing discrimination in the background conditions of people's lives no longer exists. But that isn't the case, and therefore, the argument about reverse discrimination, I think, should be thought of as part of a trade-off. Remember, one of the big themes of the course is that policies that do good, that have good moral reasoning behind them, they typically involve trade-offs. And you then have to worry about the balance between trade-offs, as opposed to imagining that you could have a policy that would accomplish the purposes you want, which would have no negative side effects whatsoever. Secondly, affirmative action creates resentment and white backlash, which ends up strengthening prejudice. Well, this is a practical, empirical claim. You know, if it were true that affirmative action actually in the long term makes things worse, you know, if it really did, if the effect of affirmative action was that the nature of the resentments got so intense that it actually increases discrimination in the background, well, then you'd be in a spiral of escalating self-destructive policy. I don't think the empirical evidence shows that. Okay, last point. It's actually not the last point. It doesn't work. That's another objection. Obviously, if it doesn't work, it's a lousy policy. Okay, I guess we have to stop. We'll have to begin the lecture on gender with the discussion of what are the actual justifications for affirmative action. But since those justifications bear on the problems of gender inequality as well, I think it's okay for us to begin that way. See you after the break. Hope you get your batteries recharged for the last part of the semester.